You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Marcel Theroux's novel Far North is about the adventures of the last surviving member of a community that has been devastated by the effects of global warming, and it's been called the first great cautionary fable of climate change. I spoke with Mr. Theroux about his novel, which was nominated for this year's National Book Award back in November, and we thought that we would re-air that conversation for you today. In addition to being a novelist, Marcel Theroux is also a documentary filmmaker and a television personality, and I started off our conversation by asking him, didn't you host a series of programs on climate change for British television?
I did. Actually, what it was, I made a 90-minute film about climate change in 2004 for British television, and that was one of the seeds for the book Far North. Because there's a habit when people think about climate change to get caught up in discussions about concentrations of carbon in the atmosphere and quite dry scientific facts. And during the course of making that documentary, I was lucky enough to travel to some interesting places and talk to some fascinating people, including James Lovelock, who's this scientist who has a theory, the Gaia hypothesis, which is that the world is like a single self-sustaining organism. And during the course of making the program, it struck me that what was interesting about climate change wasn't to do with methane, clathrates, and these kind of rather abstruse things. It was the fact that in the event of catastrophic climate change, there'll be a terrible increase in the number of hungry people on the planet. And when human beings are hungry and thirsty, and when they see their children suffering, they become desperate. And this is the reality of this is the kind of thing that intrigued me when I began the book.
It's also the subject of Cormac McCarthy's book, The Road. Were you aware of it when you started writing this?
When I was writing Far North, I came across a review of The Road in The Economist, and I had that slight dreadful prickle up the back of the neck that a writer gets. I steered absolutely clear of it, because I sort of realized there was some commonalities. And I've got The Road on my bedside table, but from people who've read both, I'm told that it's not a macho book. There's a lot of compassion and empathy and ultimately hope in my novel.
Well, also in The Road, they're going south because things are so cold. In your book, people are going north because it's cold in the south. The novel set it in an unspecified time in the future and takes place in Siberia, where Americans and other people from the South have settled to escape the effects of global warming. Makepeace, your narrator, is the child of Quaker parents who came to Siberia from Chicago with other refugees from the developed world and founded a town called Evangeline. And they did it before the climate change.
Yes, writing the book, I was thinking that I watched quite a lot of John Ford westerns, and I was interested in the way one of the subtexts of westerns is that they're about people trying to bring civilization to an empty land, and they're about trying to establish law and order and kind of functioning justice systems and systems that work without violence being something that people resort to frequently. And it struck me that my book is kind of an anti-Western. It's about the opposite. It's about civilization retreating and leaving a place empty. And, I think it was just
almost like a ghost town.
Yes, it becomes a ghost town. That's right. And I wanted the reader to it's not clear from the off what kind of world we're inhabiting. And I think one of the things that struck me was that in some ways, we assume the future. We tend to assume the future is going to be better and more progressive than the past. But in my book, the future bears strong resemblance to elements of America's 19th century past.
In your story, they left before climate change forced them. Were they originally just looking for a simpler, quieter life? Are these like the Europeans who came to this continent?
I think,
and created communities, some good, some not so good?
Well, there's an element of that in the book, but I was thinking more that a lot of us, have this hunger for a kind of a simpler societies. I think we look around, those of us who live in cities, we find the pace of life a bit hectic, sometimes threatening. And the Makepeace's parents are utopians, and they are drawn to a place to make a fresh start. And I don't think there's a single person out there who hasn't been attracted by the notion of taking their kids to a beautiful, green, unspoiled place and being closer to the natural world.
Well, why would you set the story in Siberia rather than Alaska or northern Canada or Scandinavia?
Siberia is a place that I have been lucky enough to visit on several occasions.
For the Discovery? You did a documentary for the Discovery
Channel?
Yeah,
I made a number of films there, actually. I think I've been there half a dozen times for Discovery and for British TV. And it's not what you think at all. People imagine a landscape of a kind of desert of ice and snow, but it's actually, parts of it are very alpine looking, and it's absolutely ravishing. It's absolute, parts of it so beautiful, pristine. It's so beautiful, and it has a kind of epic feel to it.
Well, we associate it with Russian prisons going back to the Tsarist times.
Well, there's an element that's definitely a feature of its history too. Yeah,
Is the climate getting warmer there?
It definitely. If you talk to whoever you talk to, I mean, the scientists tell you that the bulk of climate change is happening in the northern latitudes anyway. But if you talk to, I've had conversations with, you know, Evan reindeer herders who will tell you that the winters are nothing like they as cold as they used to be, and even that the ice on lakes is not freezing as thick as it used to.
Do you think a lot about the science behind global warming? Because you said that's not what you were thinking about when you're writing this book, but I have a listener who's been writing to me about what he sees as a biased approach to the issue. He recommends an author who's written two books on the subject, the first called A Political Guide to Global Warming, suggesting that there's been distortion, really bad science that has generated the man as the culprit issue, and that there's a thrill of disaster that permeates much of the rhetoric from has led to alarmism, he says. In the second book, Red Hot Lies, the claim is made that there's a lot of money and recognition to be made from man-made global warming and related catastrophe scenarios.
It's very interesting. I don't know these two, I don't know the books you're referring to, but what's
Well, these aren't the only books. It's just in this case, I think that this is a relative that he wants me to have on the show.
Sure, I bet he does. And this is a very interesting area. And I do try and stay abreast of climate change subjects just as a concerned citizen, not as a scientist. And what you find is that scientifically, there is a very broad consensus about the reality of climate change. And it's interesting. Wearing my other hat and being sometimes in the media, we have a habit in the media of constructing the climate change debate as though on one side there's those who believe it and those on the other side there's those who for their good reasons don't believe it. In truth, there really isn't the debate is that those who don't believe in it are a very small group, a very marginal. You will be hard put to find one respectable scientist who's written articles in peer-reviewed journals debating the truth of climate change. What you do find are respectable scientists who will say, notwithstanding the fact that climate change is real, is anthropogenic, i.e. man-made, and is occurring, it may not be as serious as some people say. And even if it is as serious as some people say, it's debatable whether we can do enough to ameliorate it for it to be worth doing. But what you don't find is respectable scientists with strong credentials saying, this is just a load of nonsense and it's not happening. You find a few marginal figures who say that very loudly. And as a habit, people in the media have tended to give them a disproportionate amount of airtime. No one will ever be persuaded. Look how long it took for people to accept the link between smoking and lung cancer.
My guest is Marcel Theroux. He's written a novel called Far North, which is published by Farrar, Straus & Drew. You also went to Chernobyl 15 years after the disaster there. I'm assuming that what you saw led you to describe some of the landscapes in this book.
Yes, I was. It's an extraordinary place, Chernobyl. And when I was there, I met this old lady called Galina Petrovna, who is one of these, what they call self-settlers, who have gone back to live on the poisoned land around Chernobyl nuclear power station. And because they're elderly, the government more or less lets them live there, even though it's obviously not that great for you to be eating cabbages that have grown on soil with a high proportion of radionuclides in it. And at the time, I thought, she was an astonishing woman and so resourceful and growing cabbages and living by herself and just hardy. And I thought, this is like, looking back, this is like, you know, the 1850s, you know, the way she was living. And then during the course of researching the film I made about global warming, I actually happened to go back to Chernobyl again. And I started to think, you know, actually, in a world where the technology that we depend on has failed to work, Galina Petrovna with her cabbages and her homemade dumplings is actually in a much better state than I am. I mean, I would be finished if I couldn't, you know, go to the Stop and Shop and fill my basket. Whereas, so I started to think, you know, maybe this old lady in the exclusion zone, rather than being an image of the past, is an image of what the future might look like.
Although you don't get specific about when in the future this book takes place. When it opens, Make Peace, who's the last surviving citizen of Evangeline, goes out to patrol the town, even though there's no one else living there. And Make Peace goes out to look for other settlements after seeing a plane crash in the mountains outside of town, reasoning that any place with the wherewithal to build and fuel a plane must be doing better than the town that Evangeline, the town of Evangeline. So did the novel begin with imagining what it would be like to be the last living member of a community?
It did. I wish it had started in such a sensible way, but it didn't. Far North really began with me crumbling into a diary that I keep beside my desk as a way to just kind of vent my frustrations when work isn't going very well. And I was just venting my frustration. I happened to write the line, you just got to buckle on your guns and go patrol the dingy city. I was kind of just giving a G up to myself. And reading it back, I was suddenly struck that that didn't sound anything like me. It was far more resourceful and practical than I am. And I became fascinated by that voice. And pretty soon it generated another sentence and another. And it was through hearing that voice that the character of Make Peace was created.
And that actually is the first line of the book.
Yeah.
So you're one of those writers who starts off with a line and then the book follows.
Well, on this occasion, I was, yeah. This book took shape in a very kind of instinctive, and I felt very lucky as it was arriving.
There are some surprises that reviewers have revealed. I've tried to avoid doing that, which has led to some weird circumlocutions. But doesn't it bother you that some readers will know a lot about your story when they open the book?
Well, I don't mind. You know, I wrote it to, I kind of designed it like a roller coaster for the reader to get onto the Far North roller coaster and their thrills and spills and they arrive at the end. But to be honest, I'm so happy with the reception the book's got that I can't really begrudge the odd plot spoiler that might have emerged so far.
Well, I'm not going to reveal.
Well, you're very kind, Leonard. Thank you.
And the National Book Awards are going to be announced tomorrow. Do you think winning an award like that or even being nominated makes a difference?
It definitely makes a difference. It definitely makes a difference. It makes a difference to the way the book is received, and it makes a difference. Maybe it shouldn't, but it just makes a difference psychologically, because writing can be kind of lonely and thankless at times. So it's lovely to have this pat on the back. And in fact, I'm so happy to, you know, I'm not even thinking about, you know, the possibility of winning. I'm just honored to have made the shortlist.
Well, good luck anyway. But weren't you warned about the loneliness? You come from a literary family. Your father is Paul Theroux. Your uncle and brother are also writers. And I'm assuming that that growing up surrounded by writers either led you to be a writer or to thinking, I never want to be a writer.
I think I've been through both states of mind, sometimes even simultaneously. But I don't know. I've probably got a slightly warped notion of what my dad Paul is. He's been very successful, far beyond what a writer can expect. But I do know he's very good about the loneliness and drudgery. And I've seen him. I'm lucky enough to be one of those people who actually has seen what they're you know, seems someone who's seen what their dad does. I mean, a lot of people just go to the office. You never really know what your dad does. But I saw him, and I know what he had for lunch, and I knew the trouble it cost him to write a book, and so I went in with my eyes open.
He also traveled a lot and wrote books about that. And here you are, going to Siberia and Chernobyl and elsewhere, and incorporating that material into this book, which, by the way, has lots of twists and turns. I don't want to suggest that this is a simple story, and it's definitely a story about human nature.
Yes, I hope
fight for survival.
And I hope also that it's ultimately a kind of hopeful, compassionate story that readers will not close feeling that all is despair. That at the heart of it is a very powerful, compelling character who kind of embodies all that I think is best about human beings.
This is your fourth novel.
That's right.
Are you working on another one?
I am working on another one. Yes, and I'm one of these superstitious people who hates talking about what they're doing when they're working on it. That's really annoying when they then come on the radio and tell you that. But yeah, I'm working away on something at the moment.
Far North is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. My great thanks to Marcel Theroux for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic Paul Goldberger talks about the role that buildings can play in our lives, and you can see a slideshow of some of the buildings he'll be discussing on our show page at wnyc.org. This is WNYC and wnyc.org.